You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Jake Jacobson. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, August 11th, 2021.
Later in the program, WFHB News speaks with Bruce Kettler, director of the Indiana State Department of Agriculture, about grant funding for farmers impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment. In today's installment, called the Unsubscribe Scam, Richard Fish describes a new twist on installing malware on your computer or digital device. But first, your environmental news brief.
From WFHB, this is your environmental news brief for Wednesday, August 11th. I'm Nathaniel Weinzapfel. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management has recently released a study that indicates that state recycling goals have not been met. Of the 8.8 million tons of waste collected in 2019, only 19% were able to be recycled, which is far below the 50% goal set by the department. The recycling industry directly supports 8,533 jobs, which adds $1.7 billion to Indiana's economy. The study also concludes that messaging around recycling can be improved through a focus on the economy. By recycling, Hoosiers are not just saving the environment, but they are also helping their fellow citizens who work in the industry. In southern Indiana, citizens have coined a new nickname for a proposed pipeline under the Ohio River as the Pipeline to Nowhere. Texas Gas Transmission LLC, a Kentucky-based company, is seeking approval to build a natural gas pipeline under the Ohio River to connect out-of-state fuel to proposed Indiana power plants. This project corresponds to CenterPoint Energy's plan to build two new gas-fired turbines in Posey County. The Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission has not yet approved the project and denied a similar petition in the past. The final story of the day is about the main takeaways from the recently released United Nations Climate Report. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has concluded that humans have reached a tipping point and that the world will be unable to avoid some of the most disastrous effects of climate change. This includes widespread droughts, heat waves, and massive amounts of flooding. However, if the world acts with a sense of urgency and aggressively cuts emissions as soon as possible, the report concludes that damage can be limited to the effects of a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperature. Activists urge folks to contact their representatives and tell them to support immediate actions to protect the climate. That's all for your environmental news brief. For WFHB, I'm Nathaniel Weinzapfel.
The Bloomington Commission on Sustainability discussed the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's recently released Climate Change Report. At the August 10th meeting, Assistant Director of Sustainability Lauren Clemens summarized the report, which the IPCC released on August 9th. She outlined the two major takeaways.
The recent technical report really just emphasizes that it's unequivocal that climate change is caused by humans and burning of fossil fuels. And I think that's become increasingly more evident to the general public this summer as the prevalence of wildfires and flooding, and even here in Bloomington, some flooding events have emphasized to more of the public that this is an urgent threat. The other thing that the report really emphasized is that these are happening because of climate change. The attribution science has been more difficult to pin what's an extreme weather event versus specifically related to climate change. But the scientists have a consensus that when we see things like the massive wildfires in the West right now, it is extremely unlikely that that was what happened absent climate change.
Commissioner Christina Anderson wondered what commissioners could do broadly to help reduce Bloomington's carbon footprint systemically. Clemens said that the Commission on Sustainability exists as a connection between residents and the City Council. She suggested the Commission could use this link to help educate residents.
For me, the connection between this commission and the community can be strengthened, and it's been difficult to find ways to do that during COVID. It's unclear how much longer we'll have to be virtual, but I liked the idea last time about having a speaker, and if there was a topic where we wanted to invite someone to speak and then do a live stream on social media and have a commissioner organize that, we could continue to do that every couple of months moving forward. And if we're able to transition into a live format, I think the educational connection between this commission and the rest of the community who is looking for ways to productively engage on this issue is important as well.
The next Commission on Sustainability meeting is September 14th.
At the August 10th Monroe County Council meeting, County Attorney Margie Rice talked about the county health order. Rice addressed the Ellettsville Town Council's suggestion that Monroe County health orders do not affect the town of Ellettsville. She said some cities are authorized to have their own health departments, but that she does not believe this applies to towns.
So the state of Indiana has divided up itself into 92 counties, and there is a county health department in each county that has countywide jurisdiction. Now, there is authority for some cities to have their own their own department. I don't believe that that same authority applies to incorporated towns. And certainly the health department, when I ask the attorney if she could then direct me to the Ellettsville health department so I could talk to them about their jurisdiction, of course, there is no Ellettsville health department.
Rice added that she believed state law required charter schools, such as Seven Oaks Classical School, to follow county health orders as well. The Monroe County Council also discussed creating a new full-time position in the Highway Department. Highway Director Lisa Ridge requested council members allow the Highway Department to convert a part-time position into a full-time one. She said the employee requested to work full-time but did not want to work a union job.
This position right now is actually one of our retirees. He worked for us for over 30 years. He knows how the county works. He would like to work full time again at the county, but not be in the union and not be out doing snow removal. He feels like he's done his time for that, but he would love to still assist at the county.
County Council Administrator Kim Schell pointed out the job would need an official classification from Wagner, Irwin, Scheel and Associates, who are currently auditing the county's job descriptions. Rice suggested that council members table the position until the August 24th meeting, so they could vote on it with approval from WIS. Council members voted to do so unanimously.
Now it's time for your feature report. WFHB News Director Kate Young spoke with Bruce Kettler, Director of the Indiana State Department of Agriculture, about grant funding available for farmers who are impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. We turn to Cade Young for that interview.
Bruce Kettler, Director of the Indiana State Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the WFHB Local News.
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it and look forward to the conversation.
So, Bruce, to start things off, would you walk our listeners through what the Indiana State Department of Agriculture does and the mission it serves in state government?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. We're a little bit of a unique agency within state government and certainly among our peers in other states as state departments of agriculture, in that we are not primarily regulatory. We have several divisions, one of which the Grain Buyers and Warehouse Licensing Agency is and does have regulatory authority to license grain buyers in Indiana. But our other divisions really are service-oriented and market-oriented. So, for example, our Division of Soil Conservation works with landowners and farmers to implement conservation practices on their farms and their lands. We've got an economic development division, which is somewhat unique to our department, again, among our peers, in that we're there to advocate for agriculture, ag business in the state of Indiana, and look in finding ways to be able to not only maybe help farmers and producers that produce the crops and livestock and products that we have in Indiana, but also then to look for ways to be able to help them get rid of, if you will, or process those products into food. It might be into fuel. It could be into fiber in some cases. So looking from an economic development standpoint, how do we make our agriculture sector in the state of Indiana more viable? And then we have a policy team that works on federal and state policy, communications team. But so we're really more, I would say, advocates for the industry versus regulatory.
Now to our main story. Starting September 1st, the Indiana Department of Agriculture will offer funding for the USDA's Specialty Crop Block Grant Program. So would you tell me what this grant funding entails?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So we have done for a lot of years, the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program is a program that we have implemented on behalf of the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA. We've done that before in other years, and typically the state of Indiana will get around $1 million. This program, the grant that is opening up on September 1st for specialty crop growers is a little different in that Congress provided some additional funding related to COVID-19 in their stimulus funding. And so this additional grant, it's about $644,000 additional that we get, is another program. It's in addition to our normal specialty crop block grants that we do, but it is related to the COVID-19 stimulus funding. And it's really, that's the intention of this round, this $644,000 of grants, is to look at our fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, maybe horticulture and nursery crop providers in the state of Indiana, and find a way to be able to maybe look at how we can provide additional relief because of the COVID and COVID-19 impact upon their business.
So how has COVID-19 impacted Indiana farmers and those working in the agricultural industry? And how do you hope this grant funding can help those impacted?
Yeah, I think, you know, the impacts have been varied, like the general population. Certainly it impacted people in many ways. You know, a lot of us knew and saw and experienced, I think it's probably even a better word, you know, the impacts of the food supply chain. It didn't completely break down. Now, there were shortages and situations where we didn't have, you know, maybe the right kind of products and food in the right quantities in grocery stores and in other providers that we had. But, you know, that got back fairly decent. You know, I would say direct impacts to farmers, there were disruptions. Maybe that's a better way to put it. It disrupted the supply chains, but we were able to kind of figure out reasonably well and in a decent amount of time how we could work through that. Obviously, food is critical and important to all of us, and so we, our industry knew that we needed to figure out what we had to do. Now, did that impact others in different ways? Certainly, you know, you think about the hospitality and restaurant industry and all those folks that food is an important part of the services that they have, that really disrupted things. And that's where there probably was as big an effect on our industry as any. For example, you know, we think about when we go to the grocery as individual consumers or families, we buy products in certain sizes and quantities that are there. That's very different if you're a restaurant, say a restaurant that, or a hotel or a school or an institution like that. They buy in very different quantities, different package types, different package sizes. So one of the biggest impacts was we weren't used to that disruption. Everything pretty much went to that individual, more that grocery type of packaging. the restaurants and hotels and that obviously shut down. So that there was a big disruption there. And so I think one of the things that we hope with this program, again, focused on the fruit and vegetable, tree nuts, horticulture crops, is, you know, that the COVID pandemic was for a lot of those folks pretty disruptive in that fashion. So what we're hoping to do is to be able to give them an extra opportunity to look at how they might be able to do something differently with research, how they might be able to enhance a market. Do they need to do some different things in terms of their training or their education? For example, do they need to train employees differently on safe food handling practices? Or some cases, we may have had people that didn't get into that, weren't into that before the pandemic. They weren't, you know, in a retail type of setting. Maybe they had to go to a retail setting to be able to survive with for their business, but that brings a whole different set of training to their employees in how they do that. Or maybe they even went just to say, you know, we're going to access a market in a completely different way than we used to. And that's what this grant program is intended to do.
So back to the grant program, who is eligible to apply for these grants?
Yeah, so it can be nonprofit, it can be for-profit organizations, could even be government, they can be private, public colleges and universities, for example. So it's really pretty broad, you know, in that aspect. But we're also looking in part of the requirements that USDA wants us to look at, and is we want to look for those non-traditional applicant organizations, and that's where getting into some for-profit or even nonprofits may not normally do that. Maybe to put it another way, people that have a certain commercial product or commercial line can't apply for this. If what they do or sell provides a profit to a single organization or institution or even a single individual, they're not eligible for that. So we're trying to get to some of those that may not be kind of traditional, if you will. So that's where we want to encourage people to look into it. They can dig into it and see if they're eligible. And, you know, our folks in the State Department of Agriculture can even help with that if there's questions.
How much funding is there in total for the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program, and where does this funding come from?
Yeah, so our normal Specialty Crop Block Grant Program is usually about $1 million. This additional new add-on for related to COVID-19 is an additional $644,000. And again, it comes from USDA. So USDA Congress, U.S. Congress provided the funds to USDA. Then we basically, I kind of think of us like a subcontractor, if you will. We've done this program before. We know and are familiar with the process. We're familiar with the grant application and what's required. And so we kind of become like a project manager that manages that piece for them. So the applications, when people send those in, they come to our department. We review them, make sure they qualify, answer questions, and then we will make recommendations to USDA on who receives the funds.
I see. Now, for those who are looking to apply, what should the project proposal explain? Like, what would an ideal project proposal look like?
I think proposals, we want them to be varied, but let me get a little more specific on some ideas that people might look at focusing on. So, is there a way to enhance food safety of a product they're producing or they want to look? Are there pest or disease issues that affect the product that they weren't aware of and want to know more about? There might be some people, for example, say, you know, I've been thinking about getting into organic crop production. I want to know more about what that looks like and how to be or how to make the crop that I'm growing more sustainable for the long term. That would be a good project. One area that they've kind of called out that I think is really interesting, and again, goes back to when we think about this being, you know, related to the COVID pandemic, is how do we develop better, stronger local or regional food systems? And that, you know, the Indiana Grown program is a program within our State Department of Agriculture that focuses a lot on local, whether that's food or other products. And I'm intrigued to see if people can apply for this grant to say, you know, we want to figure out how we develop a better, stronger local or regional food system that benefits us and can survive the hit of something like a COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, the very last question for you. When are applications due and how can folks apply?
Yeah. So the applications are due at 11:59 p.m. That's Eastern Time, of course, on October 7th. The grant applications don't open up until September 1. So they've got from September 1 until October 7th to do that. Our State Department of Agriculture, we have an online grants management system that's available to be able to put the information into and make the application. And there will be, you can go to our website, the Indiana State Department of Agriculture website. We've got links there that will be active and available and even provides information on the solicitation, what we're looking for. And then some people may even have a question, you know, which specialty crops are eligible. We'll have a link on our website to be able to show that as well.
All right. Well, Bruce Kettler, Director of the Indiana State Department of Agriculture, thank you for coming on to the WFHB Local News.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Up next, we have Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment on WFHB. Today's episode covers, quote, the unsubscribe scam, end quote, a new twist on installing malware on your computer or digital device. Host and producer Richard Fish has more.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
When you're out on the internet, you probably know that buying something, signing up for something, or going for a free trial of something, whether it's a website, a service, an app, or a product, can sometimes become a digital trap. If it's a limited-time free trial, you're asked for a credit card number and told you have to cancel the free trial before it expires, or they'll start billing you. Or maybe you start getting all kinds of emails trying to sell you other stuff. And that can happen on your desktop computer, your laptop, a tablet, or a smartphone. Getting unstuck from these mailing lists, stopping the messages or preventing charges, can be simple or it can be complicated, and now it can be dangerous too. The latest scam starts with a text or an email that looks like somebody is trying to help you. It says you've been signed up for some kind of free trial, and if you don't cancel very soon, you'll start getting charges on your credit card. Now, the text or email won't be stopped by your security program. It's safe enough. It doesn't contain any viruses or a link to an infected website. Instead, it asks you to call a phone number. If you call, a real live person will answer from a call center located heaven knows where. This person will describe the free trial offer, and at that point, you may very well say you never heard of it, or at least never signed up for it. The kindly thief you're talking to will tell you that somebody else apparently signed up for you, maybe a well-meaning friend, or maybe somebody who used your stolen information. That's plausible, since by this time we all know our personal information has been stolen in one of the many massive data hacks over the past 10 years or more. No problem, though. The person you're talking to will happily walk you through the proper procedure to unsubscribe or cancel. They ask you to go to a website, put in certain information, maybe download a spreadsheet or something, and after you go through all that, they happily assure you that you're good to go. But you're not. What you've really just done is install some kind of nasty malware on your digital device, perhaps a keylogger that lets someone spy on your every digital move, or maybe even ransomware that will encrypt all your files, lock down your device, and demand money to unlock it. So that's the setup. Hi, here's a timely warning. You have to cancel or unsubscribe soon, or we'll start charging you. Just call this number. Don't fall for it. If you ever do any kind of free trial that needs a credit card number, keep a complete record of the deal and follow the cancellation instructions that come with it. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Nathan Weinzapfel and Jake Jacobson in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Cade Young.
Better Beware is produced by Richard Fish. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Bioneers. Revolution from the heart of nature. Coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at wfhb.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,